Well, at the dawn of 1981, and in view of the political panorama of the world in general, and of our country in particular, one who has been quietly around 4.5 decades of active militancy, has also come to the conclusion now 60 that humanity, allowing itself to be eaten up by so many hucksters and so many pragmatists ingredients with which technocrats prepare themselves, finds itself submerged in an alarming dehumanization and, consequently, 2 steps away from a humiliating and cruel robotization. Unless, that is why, for some time now, I have been repeating to my companion the need I feel for a long rest and pointing out to her the convenience of thinking about retreating to a village in the Alpujarras of Granada or a small town in the Pyrenees. Lately, when she saw that my proposals were becoming formal, my companion would reply, "Well, if anything, you go ahead and I'll come later." "Yes, that's it," I would add, "you come later, I will fix up the house." A house that, by the way, is still to be found, since, by not knowing it, we do not even know the Pyrenean village or the Alpujarra hamlet of my dreams. With this he means, first, that, despite being quite discouraged, I have not yet, not even once, thought of wishing for the extermination of humanity, and, secondly, that I was preparing to get away from the madding crowd with the greatest possible discretion. So it is very likely that, on our planet, there is no person less predisposed than me to return to any kind of adventure, and even less the one that awaited me on the night of August 31st to September 1st, 1981, in the heart of the Catalan Pyrenees. But, as is well known, where one least expects it, the hare jumps, which, this time, took the fantastic and enormous form of a spaceship surrounded by a sea of light immeasurable in its grandeur and indescribable in its beauty. On the other hand, the reader must consider the story of these cosmic experiences of mine above all with a healthy curiosity. Imagine that I was explaining something practically unknown to him. For example, the customs of one of the many tribes of New Zealand where sexual initiation rites are still practiced with astonishing naturalness and spontaneity, within the family itself, where the mother initiates the sons and the father the daughters. It is not difficult to guess the face of most of those who were unaware of the existence of such sexual training practices. And no less than in tribes considered primitive and savage. Well, judging by the results, in those jungles, suicide, traumas, depressions, and of course psychoanalysts and psychiatrists are unknown, we must admit that, at least in this respect, compared to civilized societies, they are not backward, but quite the opposite. The reader should note how, now, in 1981-1982, incest is being demystified in Europe. After having insulted and defamed one of our best contemporary writers, Henry Miller, for having dared to approach and deal with incest, with the greatest naturalness in the world, in his novels, now, in our latitudes. Several television broadcasts have already been devoted to this subject. Imagine, also, the reader, that I have been discovering to you, through this orca tribe, of which Joe Akron-Grouse speaks to us in his magnificent book, the number of senses that we civilized people have lost, as an intimate resource for approaching and understanding with others, such as that of touch and even that of sight or that of silence. Well, instead of speaking to you about those things, among thousands of others, some so close, that we ignore and that continue to live and flutter on our planet, that are led by beings as terrestrial as we can be, I have spoken to you about what is popularly known as extraterrestrials, without pretending, as in the case of the tribes cited, the Orcas and the Zua, that, not being able to verify it for themselves, they believe everything I told them. But, of course, without ceasing to ask the questions that I asked myself in the spring of 1950, what if it were true that they exist? What if it were true that they are more civilized than we are? And, in that case, what would it be up to us Earthlings to do to broaden the area of our positive activities in the cosmos, in pursuit of our full and harmonious integration in it? The terror that comes from the SKY. Invented by Earthlings. Reason will tire before imagining that we marvel at the universe. Blaise Pascal. We are currently witnessing an unbridled and unhealthy pursuit of enjoyment, of pleasure without frustration. It is like a kind of evacuation of death. Claude Lévi-Strauss. This is a title that comes to us directly from one of the many magazines specialized in fantastic subjects. It is at times like this that one congratulates oneself for not having kept to oneself and to some close friend or relative who is interested, in a healthy way, in these matters. The testimony of my meeting with the 7 crew members of the spaceship Luz del Cosmos. And, when reading these texts and observing, attentively, very attentively, the illustrations that accompany them, then one feels more obliged than ever to divulge this ultimatum message from other worlds. Does the reader friend know that André Malraux called us Spanish Republicans who fought for 20-odd countries on 4 continents in the Allied ranks after having done so in our last civil war, planetary quixotes? Well, that is still where we are, apparently. But anyway, back to what we were saying. Let me clarify first, the materials I have chosen to present are what we could call basic texts. Why they chose me as a messenger, long conversations with prolonged silences, I have tripped up in a very short period of time. However, we could weave an essay on the peripheral aspects of the UFO theme and everything that the Earthlings get confused about concerning UFOs and check, in passing, in which direction the shots go, and who is firing them. Here, we do not have time or place for any essay in the strict sense of the term, but what we do is outline all the notes that we have deemed appropriate to launch to the four winds, with the hope that others use them as a platform to start what we could call the demystification and detechnification operation of the UFO theme. This is a modest counterattack to those attempts to present it to us at all times under the sign of terror. There are several fields of dissemination. In most cases it would be more appropriate to speak of exploitation, which are, television, cinema and literature. These fields are often confused. The reason is simple: the strings of this industry that exploits the extensive business of the fantastic are pulled by multinational puppeteers who work in unison. I am referring, to be precise, to the free Western world. Although sometimes in such latitudes there are some exceptions, such as France. This country, with the production of the extraterrestrials and the gendarmes and cabbage soup, whose main protagonist is, in both cases, the inimitable French comedian of Iberian descent, Louis de Funès, has come to demonstrate that the Latin vein, at least in the field of cinema, is inclined to the humorous treatment of the UFO theme. Although, moving on to the television field, in the French animated series, Once Upon a Time in Space, the distribution of roles also revolves around the good guys and the bad guys. That is to say, they follow the example of the Japanese, whose first animated series, at least in Spain, opened with the terrifying Mazinger Z. Japanese production, in this specific field of the treatment of space fantasy, more than lives up to the nickname given to them long ago, Teutons of the East. Now, with the Battle of the Planets, already brought to the literary field, the feat is rounded off, always with the children in the spotlight. Because the crux of the matter is the new generations, as usual. In addition to stupefying them, subjecting them to overwhelming school programs, quantitatively, and stupefying, qualitatively, now they are trying to sensitize them, negatively, in relation to the so-called UFO phenomenon. With all the connotations that derive from it, as is natural. As an example, see the time spent at school, and outside school, in raising awareness and stimulating, and even inciting, children to study something as wonderful as our nature and in a subject as fantastic, the most fantastic imaginable, as the observation, admiration and study of the universe. Recently, on February 5, 1982, the topic of the universe was discussed on the Spanish television program La Clave. Well, every time I see that program I ask myself the same question: how many people will have found out what it was all about? And, therefore, how many people will feel encouraged, from now on, to delve, even if not very deeply, into the subject discussed? One, who has a clear mind, can assure director of La Clave that, If I had not been somewhat informed about the subject, having been involved in it for a few months, I would not have understood anything of what was said in that broadcast. Between so much zero hour of the universe and so much talk of the Big Bang, the Great Explosion. So, without fear of being wrong, we could say that 95% of non-specialists did not understand anything. And the worst thing, if possible, is that most people would go to the other channel, which offered a mediocre work. And let's not even talk about, regarding Laclave, when historical subjects are addressed. So, if you really want to enlighten the public, we suggest that you create a broadcast entitled The Anticlave, in which you inform the public, you give them clues, that is, for their correct understanding, of what they are going to see in Laclave. Or be inspired by the television work signed and endorsed by the late Professor Rodriguez de la Fuente. Unless what is being pursued is precisely that, to tire viewers when cultural issues are dealt with on the small screen. But let us return to the terror that comes to us from heaven. If we turn to Anglo-Saxon-inspired cinema and especially North American The Wheel of Star Wars, The Empire Strikes Back, Alien and as many films as necessary to fill the cultural void of the human mind with psychological data that, who knows, may one day be useful to set the Earthlings in motion against a hypothetical extraterrestrial danger. Films that, in addition, gobble up astronomical budgets. With these films, in addition, the victims' nights are filled with insomnia or nightmares, which means that they become clients of drugs that not only do not cure anything but aggravate the patient's condition, while deteriorating the family environment and, by extension, that of those closest to him. Because, returning to the printed word, profusely illustrated with terrifying drawings, a small survey carried out by me in bookstores and kiosks gave alarming results. For example, I was assured that those who buy more specialized magazines, or paperback books, are the fathers and now, for some time now, also the mothers. Then these publications are consumed by the whole family and in particular by the children and sometimes even by the grandchildren. If children are of school or university age, when they find these literary pastimes at home, without spending a single cent of their personal capital, they usually spend their money on tobacco, drink or drugs. It is shocking and frightening to discover the statistical figures that indicate the percentages of boys and girls, sometimes still children, who take to tobacco, alcohol or drugs. Let us therefore consider the mental state in which these boys and girls approach fantasy literature, and the kind of mark it can leave on them. Not forgetting the frustrated, those who do not have the means for such vices and who must prostitute themselves or become robbers, if not murderers, to satisfy them. Because no one, in the world of children as in the adult, can live completely oblivious to the uses, customs and vices that predominate in their environment. It remains to be addressed what is known as science fiction. It is curious to marry science with fiction. The proliferation and success, why deny it? Of this literary genre is already edifying in itself. But what one does not quite understand is why authors are taking the monstrosity of their narratives to an ever greater extreme. Arguing that that is what the public wants is not valid. Each author is free to let his imagination and fantasy fly and invent all the stories or legends that occur to him. But why should they not invent happy worlds which there may be, which there are instead of intimidating, frightening and terrifying their readers? Why this malignant obsession with wanting to transfer these degrading terrestrial schemes to possible inhabited planets? In the end, by inventing worlds of terror, that terror that they say comes from the sky, taking the levels of alarmism and human unrest to the extreme, they only show that they have very little imagination and inventiveness, because, after all, the seed, the inspiration for these tormented worlds, is at hand. It is on our own planet. They are, literally speaking, plagiarists through and through, who try to infect as many Earthlings as possible with their sick tendency to distance us from life and bring us closer to death. I arrived at a family pension at dusk. While waiting for dinner, I asked the landlady to turn on the television, so I could watch the broadcast of Iberian Fauna. I was accompanied, sitting around the table, by her children, a 13-year-old girl, a 10-year-old boy and a 6-year-old girl. I tried to interest them in the natural history lessons that were being given on television. Seeing how little attention they paid me, I insisted, and then the little girl said to me, "What we like is Mazinger Z." I replied, "What I don't know is how you can like adventures in which you already know who will be the winner." The little girl then spoke up, "Well, what interests us most is to see what kind of lightning Dr. Hell, the bad guy in the Japanese style, will invent to destroy Mazinger." Immediately afterward, the boy showed me his reading book published in Plasencia, Caceres, in 1962. And it was 1976, and a sketchbook on whose pages I discovered, astonished and alarmed, 4 portraits, outlined with confused strokes. Jesus Christ and Mazinger Z were paired together, and Dr. Hell with the devil. When I acted surprised, the eldest of the brothers taught me, "Some represent good and others evil. And as our Lord did before, now it is Mazinger Z that comes to save us." Eduardo Pons Prids, Frente de Somosierra. Mundo Diario, Barcelona, September 12, 1976. Do I need to add any comments? Dear reader, space cities, made on Earth. Western science is a political instrument of domination. Robert Garrody. True scientists are poets and imaginative. Without them, science would not exist. The rest are accountants or shopkeepers. Paul Emile Victor. In truth, a large part of scientific literature is dedicated to theorizing and incredibly violent attacks on the theories of other theorists. John A. Keel. I was about to finish this book when Gerard K. O'Neill's work came into my hands, dedicated to a subject that cosmic specialists have been covering with paper with printed letters, sketches and drawings for several years now, that of cities and space, conceived and built on Earth. On the back cover we read, "Colonies of Earthlings, it is understood in orbit before the year 2000. New Hope for Humanity." This is not a science fiction book. The study by G. K. O'Neill, an American physicist, born in 1927, tells us about the construction of real cities as well as agricultural and industrial complexes in orbit around the Earth. Utopia? Not at all. Never has the marvelous been so plausible, and O'Neill's book proves, point by point, that this fascinating adventure, as well as a providential solution to the double problem of the energy crisis, as the author points out, is perfectly feasible within the framework of our current technology and resources. And another writer, famous for his tabulations on the future of the universe, Isaac Asimov, adds, "Never before has the possibility of creating artificial colonies of human beings been presented in such careful detail." Well, in view of such wonderful projects, any person with a clear mind, from Earth, of course, must immediately ask himself a series of questions. What will we bring to these space colonies? Perhaps our shameful and humiliating social status, prevailing today in our civilizations? Or the racial discriminations so fashionable in overdeveloped and highly civilized countries? Or would an order of priorities be established, so that only the new chosen ones would have access to these colonies? Because, naturally, as long as the threat of apocalyptic destruction continues to weigh on the planet Earth, the flight to these colonies would represent the survival of the fugitives or those sent on a mission. Then it would become evident, are you realizing, dear reader, where this is going? That this order of priorities would be established, indisputably, according to the financial possibilities of the Earthlings or certain influences, political or of any other kind. These colonies in space would be something like secondary anti-atomic residences of those who on Earth held, at the time of their inauguration, economic, religious, military or political power. Because, once we get down to it, no one will miss, and the Spanish, with their recent historical experiences, least of all, that the installation of these space islands could be given a predominantly religious character. Something like that of outposts or bases of a great cosmic crusade. From all this, and notes that we could continue to unravel, ad libitum, more hypotheses of this kind. It can be deduced, with little risk of error, that these colonies or space cities would end up being a faithful reflection of current life on planet Earth. Because, who would create the agricultural complexes there? The same ones who are ruining agriculture on Earth, forcing their children to abandon their land and emigrate to the big cities? Or those who have imposed the use of fertilizers, or other chemical products, or of new seeds, just to obtain quick and juicy benefits, even knowing that in this way they impoverish the land in the medium or long term? Or those who, in order to make paper pulp very cheap, hire and pay arsonists who burn our forests? Or would the leaders of these future islands, from any branch or guild, be chosen from among the Earth's elites, forming legions of subordinates with subjects, of both sexes, previously dehumanized and appropriately robotized? And let's not talk about the creation of industrial complexes in space, since, taught by Earth's experience, it is possible to predict that trade in the areas of sidereal competitiveness would end up leading, as on Earth, to a real picnic for blacks. Therefore, if before going on adventures in the universe, in the noblest sense of the word, the men and women of the Earth do not succeed in making freedom and justice, irreplaceable seats of human dignity, fully prevail on our planet, any human excursion into space will inevitably be marked by the scourges that, some more, some less, we Earthlings suffer from. And it is not unreasonable to predict, if the radical change of mentality does not occur in time in our countries, giving our life an unmistakably fraternal sense, that, as has occurred since the dawn of time at the level of nations, in the future, once these cities are installed in orbit, confrontations will occur, in the form of wars of persuasion, preventive or of extermination would develop, foreseeably, on an extraterrestrial scale. With which, those fears that the harmonious Universal Brotherhood points out in its ultimatum message would materialize with greater danger than at present, at the dawn of the decade of the 80s. Once upon a time in the future. Warning to applicants for galactic missions. The spectacle of what religions were, and what some of them continue to be, is the most humiliating for human intelligence. Henri Bergson. We have come into the world to be happy, and the worst crime we have committed is to blind the paths that lead to freedom. Antonio Gala. The Church is not interested in deep-rooted convictions, nor in the rise of the last and most incorruptible conscience. Camilo José Cela. In 1980, one of our best comic artists, Carlos Jimenez, adapted a story by the Polish writer Stanis Lalem, The Missionary, from his book The Star Diaries. The comic is very instructive for everyone, but especially for those who, in the foreseeable future, might give in to the temptation of becoming galactic missionaries or evangelizers. Here is what could happen to them. The first discoverers of Ertama did not have enough words of praise for its inhabitants, the kindly Memnagos. These beings, they said, are the most helpful, sweet, good and altruistic creatures in the cosmos. In the hope that the seed of faith would happily sprout among them, the Holy Church sent Father Oribasio to Ertama. The Memnagos received him with hospitality and almost maternal attention. They respected him, obeyed him and seemed to absorb his teachings with eagerness. Taking advantage of this favorable atmosphere, Father Oribasio did not stop preaching, day and night, the principles of the faith. Well, dear parishioners, the preacher told them one day, now that I have spoken to you about the Old and New Testaments, and the letters of the apostles, I will go on to explain to you the lives of the martyrs of the Lord. This last, by the way, was always Father Oribasio's favorite subject. Then, giving his voice thunderous intonations and his gestures a dramatic flutter, the preacher began, among others, you have the example of St. John, who attained eternal light by being boiled in oil, and that of St. Agatha, who let her head be cut off for the faith, and that of St. Sebastian who, riddled with arrows, suffered cruel torments and as a reward was received in paradise by the choirs of angels and cherubs. seeing the poor little menagos frightened, embracing each other, Father Oribasio continued to recount his rosary of martyrologies with increasing eloquence, and the example of the young martyrs who suffered the torment of quartering, strangulation, the wheel and the pyre, enduring it all in ecstasy, thus earning a place in the right hand of the Lord of the heavenly hosts. And so, day after day, he would recount to them, over and over again, and always with a voice of thunder and apocalyptic gesture, the story of many lives consecrated to martyrdom and worthy of being imitated. Until one day, a group of Memnigos approached him and began to ask him questions. "Reverend Master, forgive the audacity of your unworthy servant and tell me, does the soul of every man willing to suffer martyrdom go to heaven?" "Undoubtedly, my son." "And you, venerated father, do you perhaps wish to be a saint and go to heaven?"
"It is my most fervent wish, my son."
"In that case, we will help you," added the one who seemed the most daring of all. Then the Memnigos gently but firmly grabbed the missionary and dragged him towards Father Oribasio. Somewhat alarmed, exclaimed, "Hey, can you tell me what you're doing?"
"Dear father, we're going to skin your back and smear it with boiling pitch, just as the executioner of Ireland did to Saint Hyacinth," answered one of the little men.
Father Oribasio struggled like prey being led to the slaughterhouse, shouting and insulting them with his powerful voice, no doubt so that, frightened, they would let him go.
"No.
Let me go.
You're crazy.
Let me go, I told you.
Let me go, you damned fools."
And while they tied him to what would be a stake for the martyrology, the Memnigos told him, "Now, venerated father, we are going to cut off, among other things, your left leg, as the pagans did to Saint Paphnutius. And then, beloved master, we will open your belly and fill it with straw, just as they did to blessed Elizabeth of Normandy." The missionary continued to struggle like a caged animal and scream like a cornered beast. And while they continued to mark his body with the mutilations and wounds that would make him worthy of the title of martyr of the church and reach the rank of saint, the Memnigos announced to him the other steps of the martyrology. "Now we are going to impale you as the Amalekites did to Saint Hugo. But, first, dearest pastor, we will break your ribs as the Tyrocusans did to Saint Henry of Padua. And now, next, reverend master, we will burn you slowly, as the Burgundians did to the Maid of Orleans." After all this, the Menagos began to cry with tremendous grief for their beloved pastor lost forever. And when anyone approached them, they found them like this, desperate, sobbing bitterly. And they gave them all the same explanation. "Father Oribasio always told us that there was nothing that a good Christian would not do for his neighbor. So we desperately renounced our salvation. Also that dearest Father Oribasio would have the crown of martyr and sanctity. No one can imagine how hard it was for us. Because before Father Oribasio came to Urtama, no one here was able to kill a fly. Why they chose me as a messenger. We workers have always lived in shacks and hovels. We will have to adapt to them for some time yet. But let us not forget that we also know how to build. We are the ones who have built the palaces and cities in Spain, America and throughout the world. We, the workers, can build new palaces and cities to replace those destroyed. New and better ones. We are not afraid of ruins. We are destined to inherit the earth, of that there is not the slightest doubt. The bourgeoisie may blow up the world, their world, before leaving the stage of history. But we carry a new world within us and that world grows every moment. It is growing while I speak to you." Words of Buonaventura Durruti, in the autumn of 1936, on the Aragon front, addressed to the Dutch journalist Van Paysen. After having recorded the message, and after a brief silence, I said, "Can I ask you a question?"
"As many as you like," they replied, "and you can ask them without any kind of restrictions.
Why are you entrusting this message to me and not to some important statesman, or to a high-ranking and responsible military officer from one of the two superpowers?" They did not respond directly to my question immediately. They told me that,
As a result of their observations, they had come to the conclusion that the communities on Earth that still retained a certain amount of humanity were precisely in the Mediterranean basin. They were not unaware that in other parts of the planet there were communities subjected to truly inhuman living conditions, particularly in Africa, the Spanish-speaking Americas and in Asia. But they did not fail to recognize that these communities, not enjoying a reasonably good level of energy, would take a long time to awaken from their lethargy and claim the place that rightfully belongs to them within the great terrestrial community.